In May, the national significance of Brown versus Board of Education will be roundly explored. But this morning, we want to revisit what was happening locally in the years and months before this Kansas case became national news. With us to do that are Gretchen Eich, author of Dissent in Wichita, and Nick Murray of the Brown versus Board of Education National Historic Site. Gretchen Eich literally wrote the book on this. That book, Dissent in Wichita, traces the contours of race relations and Black activism in an unexpected locus of the civil rights movement, revealing that the movement was a national phenomenon, not just a Southern one. Good morning, Gretchen.
Good morning, Gina.
What is that perception that this is a Southern movement? Can you explain that?
There's a lot of common belief that the South was the only locus for the for segregation and the only locus for the civil rights movement. But in actual fact, segregation was everywhere. It happened in most communities in the United States. Wichita, Kansas was, by a number of sociological studies, one of the most segregated cities in the country, even though it's in the Midwest.
Kansas also has that free state history, that sort of special relationship with the Civil War, and a lot of people coming to Kansas trying to be really activists for freedom. How did that play into the history of race and education in Kansas in any significant way?
You know, that's a very interesting observation. Because Kansas is a state of extremes. It has been all along. There was a major battle over whether we would be a free state or a slave state. There were two governments in those early years before Kansas became a state. And the tension was so great that some people have said the Civil War really began in Kansas. Kansas was a place that people from Missouri who had been enslaved could flee to, and abolitionists in Kansas would help them get north along the river and up to Canada, which was the only place in the United States that was safe until after the passage of the 13th Amendment in 1865. So there was a lot of hostility to abolition. There was a lot of hostility to Kansas as a free state, but there were also very strong advocates of Kansas being anti-slavery, and people willing to risk $1,000 fines and 6 months in prison to help people escape from slavery.
I want to get to our next guest in just a second, but before segregation was law, was there informally on some level any experience of integrated education in Kansas?
Yes, actually, segregation as law didn't come until anywhere in the United States, really, until about the 1890s, and especially in the first decade of the 20th century. And in Kansas, it was like with Plessy versus Ferguson, the Supreme Court case in 1896. It said that cities could segregate. They could pass segregation of schools ordinances. And so cities that were larger cities tended to do that. Cities that were smaller cities, you know, if you had only 100 or even 30 or fewer African-American kids in your city, it didn't make any sense to pass, no matter how much the public pressure might be on, it didn't make any sense economically to create a separate school system. So most of Kansas did not have separate schools because most of Kansas had small Black populations. But the cities were different, cities like Wichita, Topeka, Kansas City.
Well, we'll get back to Gretchen Eich, author of Dissent in Wichita, in a moment. But also with us by phone is Park Ranger Nick Murray at the Brown versus Board of Education National Historic Site. Good morning, Nick.
Good morning.
So every day is a commemoration of Brown versus Board of Education for you. Is that correct?
Absolutely.
So how does the event of the 60th anniversary of that decision affect you in your line of work?
Well, it's a perfect time to reflect and look back at where we were, what was the promise of Brown, and has that promise become a reality? And that's something that we try to remind our visitors every time they come and visit the site, but especially now having this monumental time to look back and reflect on 60 years of Brown.
So, Nick, recap for those listeners who may not have revisited this history as recently as you last did. What is Brown versus Board of Education? What was the decision? Why is it related to Kansas?
Well, Kansas kind of had the perfect backdrop to test this idea from Plessy in 1896 of separate but equal that allowed segregation to happen in the United States.
Let's explain Plessy for the history brush-up.
Yeah. So in 1892, Homer Plessy agrees to be arrested to challenge the segregation laws in New Orleans, specifically on interstate railroad. So pretty much your commuter type trains in Louisiana and New Orleans. And so he agrees to be arrested for violating these laws, and eventually it makes its way up to the Supreme Court in 1896. And so in this case, the Supreme Court's looking at the 14th Amendment Equal Protection Clause, which states that no state shall deny any person within its jurisdiction the equal protection of the law. And so they're looking at this word equal, and they come to the conclusion that segregated facilities are fine. They're fine with this under this idea of equal, allowing them to be separate but equal facilities. So therefore, we now have the highest court in the nation sanctioning segregation within states. And Kansas did kind of end up, as Gretchen said, adopting these type of laws, especially in schools, but only in what they called cities of the first class. And so those are cities of like Wichita, Kansas City, Topeka, cities of 15,000 people or more.
So Nick,
but because of Kansas's unique history, they tried to live up to the idea of separate but equal.
Yeah, Nick, why don't you explain to us where you left off saying that Kansas was this perfect storm?
Yeah, so because of that, there's a long history in Kansas. We know of at least over a dozen cases where they're challenging segregation laws. And every single one of these cases, the Supreme Court in Kansas at least says, equalize, make these schools equal.
What are some of the ways in which they typically were not?
So usually if they weren't, it was because of facilities were long distances away, or else they're older facilities, teacher pay. Lots of times this came down to the issue of transportation. They didn't like the idea of sending their kids and having them commute across town and going to these segregated facilities. And each and every single one of these cases, pretty much, the Kansas Supreme Court declares that the schools at least must equalize. And so they're looking at school funding, making sure that the teachers are paid the exact same, that the building structures are at least similar to the white counterparts, that they're not tar paper shacks, kind of like when you're dealing with schools from the South. They're nice brick structures. And so here in Kansas, we have that idea of separate but equal in practice.
Gretchen, I want to invite you to jump in here. Can you give us some context?
We have some context from Wichita, because, in fact, schools were segregated in Wichita. In fact, Wichita's NAACP had to bring action at the national level in 1966 to challenge the ongoing segregation. That's 12 years after Brown. And, in fact, Kansas had the first investigation of a school system in Wichita, that happened to be Wichita, of a school system that was not in compliance with that 1954 Supreme Court decision that segregation was inherently unequal. The segregation was done by using portable classrooms, by assigning black teachers only to black schools, to schools that were 95% black or so, done by redrawing the boundary lines so that every 2 years the school district would look at where the population had moved. So if a neighborhood had now a significant number of African Americans in it, the boundary would be drawn so that those kids would be directed to a school that was 90% black for their education up through the eighth grade. Kansas never segregated above that. The schools were not segregated for high school, but they were up to eighth grade. And there was a legal change, but there was in practice a de facto practice that continued. And I think it happened in Topeka and in Kansas City, just as it did in Wichita.
Gretchen,
it required a state challenge. I mean, a challenge at the national level with the Supreme Court, and it required a judgment by the Supreme Court that they would actually withdraw all federal funds from the city of Wichita if they did not address this practice of de facto segregation. And finally, they did in 1971.
Gretchen, you mentioned black teachers, and this brings up an issue that not everyone who was in favor of equality favored desegregation, in part because of concern for the careers of black teachers. Can you talk about some of the concerns?
Yeah. Well, Wichita was approached by the National NAACP about being the case, one of the five cases that would go to the Supreme Court under the label, eventually, of the label of Brown. Before they went to Topeka, they came to Wichita. And there were teachers here in Wichita were very concerned that if, although they supported desegregation of schools, and they definitely supported equalization of school facilities and the qualifications of the teachers and the books and so forth, they were afraid that if desegregation came, it would actually mean that the school district, which was, you know, governed mostly by European Americans, would choose to not place black teachers in those newly integrated schools. Black teachers had historically only been placed in black schools. And so they said they didn't want to be part of the case. So then the NAACP went to Topeka, and the rest is history. Topeka became one of the five cases that was bundled together and taken to the Supreme Court.
Nick Murray, the rest is history indeed. Can you set the stage for the specific case in Topeka that ended up becoming Brown versus Board of Education?
Yeah, absolutely. But I kind of wanted to touch on Gretchen's question a little bit, too.
Please do.
There's a perfect example of Topeka, some of the teachers being reluctant to support the case that eventually became Brown versus Board of Education. Because in 1941, there was a case out of Topeka that challenged segregation in junior highs. And as a result, the junior highs were integrated in Topeka, but eight African-American teachers lost their jobs because of this. And so there was a lot of reluctance to have from the professional teacher community in Topeka to join this, and also an internal struggle within the local chapter of the NAACP of whether to support this or not. But eventually what ended up happening is that they were able to recruit 13 members from the community who lived in neighborhoods that were outside of the segregated African-American school that their kids went to. And so they asked them to go and enroll in their neighborhood school that they would have been able to attend had race not been a factor. And, of course, in each of those instances, the 13 parties were not allowed to enroll and told to go and enroll in their segregated facility. So this is what sets up what is now known as Brown versus Board of Education. And when these 13 members went out and tried to enroll their kids in their neighborhood schools, and then, of course, were denied admission to those schools because of race.
So, Nick, tell us who this Brown character is.
Yeah, so the person who is named after is Oliver Brown, and he was one of the 13 members that participated in the court case, and he became the lead plaintiff. He was the only male figure in the case. The others were 12 housewives or other professionals, but he worked for the Santa Fe Railroad, and so he had a secure job there as well, but he was also an associate pastor at one of the local churches as well. And in his instance, for his children, had the race not been a factor, they would have went to the nearby Sumner School, which is only about 5 or 6 blocks away from their home. But instead, they were forced to take a bus about 15 or 17 blocks away and attend the Monroe School, which is where we are today at Brown versus Board of Education, is the old Monroe School.
And this was one of 5 cases nationally that were attempting to overturn Plessy, which you summarized before, the ruling that had allowed for separate facilities if those facilities were, at least in theory, equal. This is the case that emerges that goes all the way to the Supreme Court. Gretchen, do you have any perspective on why this is the one that went all the way?
Well, this was these 5 cases, and the NAACP had been bringing court cases attacking various levels of segregation, starting with the grad schools, back from very early on in the in the late 30s, they're even bringing cases. And the strategy of the NAACP was to start with graduate schools because people were trying to get into law school or med school at a state university. Their parents were paying taxes to that state. They were obviously extremely intelligent and accomplished people to be going to grad school, that they could chip away gradually at these segregation laws. And they were successful. Although the success came in very humiliating doses. For example, when the law school, University of Maryland, I believe, had to open up, they ended up creating a separate little carrel, like a fenced-in carrel for that black student who was going to be able to study there. And then they had to go back and challenge that. So it was a process of chipping away by court case after court case. NAACP would provide the legal assistance because it's very expensive to try to do that. And so now by 1952, they've reached the level of, okay, let's tackle segregated schools in the public school domain, in the elementary school and junior high school level.
Nick Murray of the Brown versus Board of Education National Historic Site, can you tell us anything about the Brown family and how they experienced this journey from a local legal proceeding to a Supreme Court case in their name?
I can tell you a little bit about it. Being that their name was alphabetically the first, that's kind of how they ended up becoming the lead, at least in the Topeka case. But as far as what they experienced at the local level, there really wasn't too much drama involved in this. There weren't mass protests in Topeka or any sort of sentiment. Kind of like, for example, the case that came out of South Carolina was Briggs versus Elliott. In that court case, the community leaders involved in it all lost their jobs. And people who took part in those plaintiffs of the case, every single one of them lost their jobs. Some of them were ran out of town. One of the local community leaders, he was a pastor, and his church was bombed in this. We don't have those instances here. In Topeka, it was relatively quiet. In fact, most of your people living in Topeka probably weren't even aware of the court case until after the decision happened. And so their day-to-day struggles, at least publicly, we haven't historically have anything written down too much about their experience. Maybe individually they share these stories of maybe these things that may have happened on the side, but they've never publicly really shared them with anybody as far as it's being written down in history.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to Central Standard on KCUR 89.3 FM, streaming live at kcur.org. Next month, our nation will be commemorating the 60th anniversary of Brown versus Board of Education, the Supreme Court decision that separate but equal was inherently unequal. Based on this case, the Supreme Court ordered that American schools integrate, quote, with all deliberate speed. I'm Gina Kaufman, here with Gretchen Eich, author of Dissent in Wichita, and Nick Murray, park ranger at the Brown versus Board of Education National Historic Site. If you have a desegregation story based in Kansas, you will have the opportunity to share it. StoryCorps is conducting a special oral history project in Topeka, the city at the heart of this historic event. For details on that opportunity and how to participate, please visit kansashumanities.org. I want to get back now to Gretchen Eich. Gretchen, your book is about Wichita, not Topeka, but I wonder if the story that you tell in that book can inform our understanding of what sets the stage for this even better. So first of all, what inspired you to write that book?
Well, I had been looking at a number of topics in African American history, and my professor said there was a little known sit-in that took place in Wichita that no one had ever written about, but it was earlier than the sit-ins in the South, and that we really needed to have somebody do some research on that. And you're probably aware that now we know that the Dockham drugstore sit-ins in 1958 were the first successful student-led sit-ins that have been documented so far, and the Smithsonian will actually be reflecting that in the new African American Museum, which is very exciting. And then I went on to say, okay, I'm going to start with the 58 and the sit-ins, but I'm going to really try to take it for the next 20 years and not just look at Wichita, but look at what was happening nationally and kind of do a back and forth, because Wichita played a major role in the national civil rights movement as well. I did want to say something about the second part of what you just said about the decision by Brown, which is usually referred to as Brown 2. There was a second decision, how to implement the Brown decision, that was made a year after the 1954 Brown decision by the U.S. Supreme Court. And that was that it would be implemented with all deliberate speed and would be implemented by federal district court judges. They would have the oversight of this, which meant that the federal district court judge who lives in the community, who socializes with people in the community, would have to be the person that desegregated the schools in the community. And as Nick was saying, places like South Carolina, places like Virginia, you're going to have tremendous resistance. In fact, you had almost all members of Congress, with some very notable exceptions, who were from Southern states, signed a Southern Manifesto in 1956 pledging that they would oppose school desegregation with every means possible, short of violence. And there was tremendous opposition. People set up Christian academies, private schools to avoid desegregation. That's the origin of most of those schools. And it also took a long time for the Brown decision to really be implemented. In Wichita, typically of other communities, it took until 1971-72. And most often, school boards avoided desegregation by doing things like redrawing the boundary lines or passing what they called freedom of choice plans, where a black parent could say, I want my kid to go to this integrated school, or I want them to go to this really good school that is now like 99% white, but I want my child to go there. They could petition the school board, and the school board would make the decision whether or not that child could go on a case-by-case basis. If they decided the child could go, the parents would have to provide the transportation, which could mean that for parents who have different ages of children in different schools, this could be very onerous because you have to get your kid to the elementary school and pick them up in time and get them to the junior high school and get them to the high school and back. And it was a very, very limiting thing for African-American families. But that's the same strategy that was used throughout the South. So in other words, we're seeing the same patterns in the Midwest and in the Northeast and in the West that we're seeing in the South. The issue and the process was very, very similar everywhere.
Yeah, it certainly was a long process, and one that goes all the way back to, it sounds like, the immediate aftermath of the Civil War in this country. What was it that was happening in Kansas in the aftermath of the Civil War that set the stage for some of this story to begin unfolding?
There was a major migration of African Americans into Kansas. It began really before before the war, like I said, before people seeking to escape slavery and get into the Underground Railroad's apparatus that would help them get to Canada where they could actually live in freedom. But then after the war, as the white supremacist Democratic Party took control of the South, southern states that had been part of the Confederacy, more and more people found their lives really confined and restricted and found violence, again, rearing its ugly head in southern states. And so thousands and thousands of African Americans left the South and moved to the Midwest, especially to Kansas. You see it if you look at the population figures in Kansas, from 1870 to 1880, the black population nearly doubles. And you see it in the towns that have black newspapers. You see, by the 1890s, you had Atchison and Cherokee and Coffeeville and Baxter Springs, Fort Scott, Kansas City, Lawrence, Nicodemus, Parsons, Peru, Sedan, Topeka, Weir City, Wichita, et cetera, Fort Scott, all with black newspapers because of this burgeoning migration of people into Kansas, and then later, as Oklahoma has opened up, into Oklahoma, where there will be more than 40 black towns founded in Oklahoma. So there's this massive migration. And at first, it's greeted relatively benignly by the European-American population. Probably Nick knows more about Tennessee Town than I do in the community in Topeka. But you had in Wichita, you had black police officers. You had black city clerk in the 1880s. It was a boom period. There were black businesses downtown stretching along a major street. But then in the 1890s, we had an economic depression, a nationwide economic depression. And often, historically, we see that economic depression brings a kind of a new wave of discrimination, mistreatment of minority populations.
Just competition for jobs and resources causes...
Competition, yes, exactly. And then, so the 1890s is when you get the Plessy decision and when you get segregation laws being passed. And you see the beginning in 1898, a flurry of white against black race riots happening across the United States.
Including in Kansas?
Not to my knowledge in Kansas, but in New York, in it starts in Wilmington, North Carolina, and Atlanta and Chicago, and just across the country, there are many, many race riots.
Nick,
recur in the act in 1913.
Nick, Gretchen just mentioned Tennessee Town in Topeka. Is that something you're familiar with?
Yeah, absolutely. Tennessee Town was one of probably the more prominent African American neighborhoods here in Topeka. It was pretty much descendants of people who came from Tennessee, Kentucky area, and hence the name Tennessee Town. But they ended up settling in that area, and Buchanan Elementary served as their segregated school there. But at least here at Brown, we kind of have another partner with a local site, the John Ritchie House. It's run through the Shawnee County Historical Society, and they have a great connection here to our site at the Monroe School. They're only about 3 or 4 blocks away, and John Ritchie was an abolitionist during Bleeding Kansas and helped fight during that, and he was reportedly at least a member of the Underground Railroad that helped escape slaves, reach freedom here and then further north. But what he ended up doing is having all this land around him where the Monroe School is today, that he gave a lot of this land away, either free or at a much reduced price, to these former slaves. And so the area around Monroe School was known as Ritchie's Addition, and it became prominently African-American because of the support that he gave to the African-American community. And so that's kind of why the schools were set up really where they were built around to serve those neighborhood schools. But kind of to touch on another note that Gretchen has talked about riots and things like that, there really weren't too much going on in Kansas at that time, but in Kansas City and Wyandotte County, there was an incident where they experimented with integration for a while, but there were clashes between the white community and the African-American community, and there was at least one fatality. As a result, in 1905, they wrote special legislation that exempted Wyandotte County from all integration-type laws. And so of all the counties in Kansas, that was probably had at least the most sanctioned laws, kind of like Gretchen said earlier, Wichita may have been one of the most segregated cities in the city of Topeka, but by law, Kansas City was exempt from every integration policy and probably had the stricter laws on segregation in the state of Kansas.
I'm going to jump in. This is going so fast, and we just have a minute left. So, Gretchen, I'd like you to just... Segregation already had a long history within the education system of Kansas by the time of Brown v. Board of Education. What if you could pinpoint one thing that led that to kind of erupt before Brown v. Board, what would it be?
Well, there was black protest all along. Let's not forget that. There were people petitioning the school board, going to school board meetings in the 1940s, participating in a study of Wichita that showed that Wichita was not only just very segregated, but also that the segregation was extremely targeted toward the black community. Things like the pool, community pools, would be open to Native Americans or Asian Americans or Latinos, but would not be open to African Americans. And the black community is organized and is out there confronting again and again and again, and it's like water dripping on a rock. You know, it's just eventually there are cracks, and the NAACP's active challenges through the courts. All of this brought about the change.
Well, that's all the time we have for this conversation today, but we'll revisit the subject of Brown versus Board of Education next month as that historic anniversary approaches. Thanks so much to Gretchen Eich and Nick Murray for being here this morning. It's been a real pleasure speaking with you both.
Thank you, Gina.
To listen to today's program again, just go to kcur.org/centralstandard, where you can download a podcast of today's show. That's where you can find this morning's conversation about coping with targeted violence, as well as this more recent discussion about the history of race in Kansas schools. That website, again, is kcur.org/centralstandard. Join us again tomorrow, same time, same place, as we explore the importance of play in childhood development. Our show is produced by Matthew Long Middleton and Christy Garten with help from intern Kate Baxendale. Our announcer today is Suzanne Hogan. I'm Gina Kaufman, and that's all for today's Central Standard. Stay tuned for Up to Date next.